Still Alive, a look at people making things. The Stone Carver. Peter Brooks meets Steve Roach.
I've come out into the Peak District to one of the plantations just on the edge of Sheffield. There are trails cut through the trees, and where two of the trails cross, a large sandstone boulder has been positioned. It's about the size of a car, but only about half the height, and it has one flattish side to it.
I've got a piece of paper that I'm holding up against the side of a boulder. It's quite a rough, sort of quarry-hewn piece of local sandstone that we've had placed here in the woods. It's a bit of a sort of mountain bike haven. And so I'm drawing on some Roman capitals, which are a bit like your Times New Roman on your computer. But they're derived from the letters that you get on the Appian Way in Rome, and they're very kind of, they're quite kind of regal and quite sort of familiar to people, and they're quite kind of architectural. That's why they use a lot in architectural letter carving and in memorials. They're just kind of, they're quite kind of human, and they sort of look right. They're easy to read. So I'm just, I've got the Roman numerals of the dates and the initials of a lad who lost his life, and I'm just marking them on now. I've already carved in, this is a bit of a companion piece to a memorial that we've already done, which is in a churchyard in Sheffield. So there's already a circular inscription next to it, and it's a bit of a pain because it's at shin height, so it's not particularly easy to get to. So I'm going to be carving kind of upside down most of today. I usually use carbon paper for these, but it doesn't really show up on the sandstone. So I'm just having to kind of mark on where I want it, and then I'm going to draw the letters by hand.
Steve's marked out the inscription using a pencil, and he's now going to start cutting the letters. He's using a traditional tapered round steel-headed mallet and a flat-bladed chisel.
So you start off cutting sort of down the middle, and what that does is it protects the pencil edges, it protects the lines that you want to get to, and then you kind of chop in from the sides to form what you call a V-cut, which is a sort of traditional way of carving letters into stone. It gives you, it sort of widens the letter slightly and brings space into it, but it also, just as I'm saying that, there's some really nice sunlight just coming across the front, which sort of gives you, because you're looking for shadows, and once you get raking light across the front, it picks up really nice shadows, and sort of they're really good letters for outdoor use, because as the sun goes round during the day, it'll cast different shadows and pick up off the bowl of the R or the straight stroke of a T or whatever it'll be. But they'll change throughout the day, and there'll be certain times of the day where it'll just really kind of, really sort of pop. Uh, I mean, the Roman letters are, they're all, there's a geometric way of working them out. So they're all based on the on a square and a circle.
So the O's are obviously based on the circle. So say something like a capital M is based, if you draw a square and you join the top two corners with the midpoint of the bottom stroke, you get yourself a V. And if you just kind of kick out from there, you get the first sort of stroke, you know, the kind of the edge legs of it. So it's all kind of geometrically sort of derivable. But also you get the little sort of flicks at the end, they're called serifs, and they're from where they used to be drawn by a brush. And the most beautiful Roman letters are still drawn with brushes. It's a bit difficult to do on this because it's really quite kind of rough, like a really rough piece of stone. And also I'm terrible with a brush. So.
Steve has to get this finished today, so I'm going to leave him to it. We've arranged to meet tomorrow in his workshop, though, because I'm really keen to find out how he started working with stone.
I used to work in sales years ago and had a bit of a nightmare month where I broke my leg and lost my job in the same month. And I always had it in my head to retrain as a stonemason or a sculptor. And I was finding it difficult finding work, so I just thought, why not just do it? And I found a company based out of Stockport who were willing to take me on as an apprentice. And it was quite kind of meaty sort of site work, masonry, sort of putting town hall steps back in, that type of stuff. So it was a bit of a kind of baptism of fire. And they would send you one day a week to York College, where they send the apprentices from the Minster, where you learn all the old hand tooling ways of doing things. Because if you're doing restoration work, it has to be done in the same way that it was done the first time round. So actually there's not that much that's changed in stonemasonry. You know, it's the same way that you set things out. It's the same way you approach the stone. It's the tools are you know, haven't really changed since day dot. So that's so after I did my apprenticeship, I was working in the Peak Districts a little bit on old churches doing restoration work. I got a bit more interested in letter carving. So I've had to sort of backfill my skills a little bit because I found that the inscriptions that I can carve can only be as good as the ones that I can draw. So I've kind of walked backwards a bit into learning calligraphy because it's obviously the sort of the kind of art of setting things out and making beautiful letters. So I ended up on the Society of Scribes and Illuminators Advanced Training Scheme, which was a 3-year course, which was hugely valuable. Because at the time I was just working 100% to commission, and it made me do my own work for my own sake, and it's massively helped me in kind of in creating beautiful memorials or beautiful objects for people.
And presumably you've been able to bring that into the work that otherwise you wouldn't have been able to do.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, so that's the kind of potted potted version of how I got here. Yeah, so after my apprenticeship, I set up a workshop here in Stagworks. It's an old cutlery factory, so it's got quite a nice sort of atmosphere. There's still people in here making things. And people help each other out a bit. You know, there's some silversmiths and jewellers who have been here since day dot. I've been here 9 years now. When I first sort of set this place up, I was doing a lot of restoration work. And it was the kind of bread and butter work that gave me the space to learn a bit of calligraphy and to send myself on courses and to give myself, yeah, that bit of elbow room to kind of upskill myself a little bit in letter carving. Letter carving took over from the restoration work, so I don't really do any of that anymore. And now the letter carving has sort of became the bread and butter stuff that let me sort of go on a couple more kind of carving courses and allowed me to sort of spend time putting bids together for public sculpture projects. that's now started to take over a little bit from letter carving. I mean, I think I'll always do letter carving and memorial work because it has its own rewards. You know, people come to me because they've lost someone a lot of the time before, you know, lost them before their time. And so they want something really meaningful. And so it's quite, it's difficult. And it was something I wasn't really prepared for, doing memorial work. But it's hugely rewarding. So I think I'll always carry on doing that sort of aspect of my business.
And I suppose that gave you a basis doing the, you know, more traditional restoration work, and then the letter carving. Putting those together allows you to do pieces that are just more artistic, I suppose, rather than purely functional work.
Yeah, I think so. I think the background in restoration has given me. I'm not afraid of moving big things around or having them moved around or, you know, installing things. I can see how that can be done, and that can be kind of worked into how I work with the organisations that I do them for. Because it's a lot of house builders and housing associations that you work for. And I think having that background allows you to sort of talk on the same. I mean, you're a tradesperson, so you're talking to somebody who's a site manager or a quantity surveyor. They're used to dealing with tradespeople, and it's something, you know, because you get like a public art thing, and they instantly think, oh god, there's going to be some sort of flouncy sculptor sort of wafting in, and you know, and all this. But I think it sort of, it puts people at ease a little bit.
Sitting in here, this is certainly not a flouncy sculptor workshop, is it? It's an honest workshop.
Yeah, it's a fairly sort of functional space, but they're a bit like Hen's Teeth in Sheffield, the like ground floor sort of roller shutters. I mean, I use this, but I'm outgrowing it ever so slightly in that the bigger commissions that I've been getting, I can't get the lorries in here with the crane on the back to actually physically get the piece of stone off. Like the boatyard twist sculpture is having to be done up at Whirlow, just because, yeah, I can't physically, like, it's a 3-ton piece of stone, you just can't get it in here through the gates.
I suppose it must be nicer to work in a variety of locations as well, though, rather than always coming to the same place to work.
Doing this job, it takes you to some quite sort of unusual places, you know, like working in the woods the other day on the Boulder Memorial. This first time I've worked in a mountain biking enclosure sort of plantation. I always think this is something that they don't really tell you when you're at school, that jobs like this can be loads of fun. Like me and a friend of mine were doing restoration on a church, and we had to try and find our way to the top of the bell tower past all the bells. And it was almost like sort of caving, but you were, you know, you were next to these whopping great big church bells. So it was actually loads of fun to sort of to figure out how to get up and down and get the tools up and down and all that.
Not something they could really teach you as an apprentice, is it? I know that you once did a work placement on a site where you're now making a sculpture for it. How did that project come about then?
When I was 14, doing your work experience, and I've just picked a random sort of card out of a big sort of box of placements, and it said it was on Sheffield Road, and I knew that a lot of them were, you had to get a couple of buses to and all this, and I thought Sheffield Road must be in Sheffield, and it wasn't, it was miles away. So I had to get two buses out there, but it was an old boatyard, it had maybe 500 you know, river cruisers and narrow boats and toppers and, you know, sailboats and all sorts, and it was kind of scraping all the sort of barnacles and bits and bobs off the bottom and repainting them and revarnishing bits of the boats and pumping water out of them and etc. And then I ended up getting a Saturday job there. So I did that, you know, when I was sort of 14, and then 25 years later was asked to do a public sculpture sort of on the site that had then been taken over by a housing association. Yeah, so it's been a bit sort of funny how it's how it all sort of it all kind of comes round.
Yeah, you kind of come full circle, haven't you?
From
at the time when you knew, obviously didn't know you were going to become a stonemason, mm. and you were just doing a, you know, work experience and then a, an ordinary Saturday job to earn a few quid on the side sort of thing, and then now you're back doing a piece of art in the same time.
Steve has recently started sharing his workshop with another carver.
So I'm Lily Marsh. I'm a stone carver based in Sheffield, and I work with stone and, yeah, carve it.
So how did you get to do that, Lily? It's not a very obvious profession for most people, really.
No, so originally I went to uni and I went through the kind of academic path and went to do psychology and then worked as a psychologist in London for about 7 years, but was miserable in my job. And so I desperately wanted to change to something more creative and manual. I really wanted to do a practical kind of physical job. So one day I was at home sick and I saw stonemasonry on telly and literally thought, that's what I'm going to do. And so I phoned up a college, a construction college, and went and signed up for their course and handed my notice in and got a part-time job and studied part-time and then qualified in with my MVQ and then went and worked on site. And so that's how I got into it initially. It was a bit of a dive away from a very kind of stressful, interesting job, but one that wasn't for me, really. I was always wanted to do creative work.
That's really interesting that you saw something on the telly and thought, oh, yeah, that's what I want to do. So no careers advice at school could have mentioned that. Or, you know, you obviously went down one path and then a fairly radical change from a, you know, a cerebral activity as a psychologist to a very practical one. So you're working on sites, what was that, restoring old buildings or new work?
So my MVQ was in heritage stonemasonry, so I'm a qualified stonemason. So I went from college and trained for the Prince's Foundation, which is a foundation set up for building, traditional building training. And from there, I worked on heritage buildings, so pre-1919 buildings, and so did restoration work. So the site work was mainly in London, mostly heritage work, and also some new build work as well. It was a commercial masonry company I worked for. So big sites, multi-trade, you know, very noisy and busy and lots of mostly men working on them. So it was an interesting place to be, enjoyable in part and, you know, challenging as well.
Is that the kind of work you prefer to do, or do you, you know, have you moved into more artistic pieces, shall we say?
I've moved into more artistic pieces because I then went on to do a carving course at the City and Guilds of London Art School, so stone carving, which specialises in kind of teaching you how to carve, but also teaching you about modelling and drawing. So I did 3 years there after working as a stonemason. So it was kind of a really good way, I think, to get a foot in terms of doing stonemasonry and feeling comfortable with working stone and, you know, how to lift heavy pieces of stone and move them around confidently. And then I went on to do the carving course where it was brilliant, like do drawing and modelling in clay and carving, you know, a head or kind of faces or more kind of decorative pieces, which then inevitably becomes a bit more artistic. So I finished that course in 2020, just as COVID hit. So I missed the last part, but I was also pregnant. So I had a baby at the same time.
When we were talking in the workshop, Steve mentioned the boatyard twist sculpture that he's creating. It's quite large, about 2 metres high, and will need a variety of tools and techniques. I'm interested to find out why you'd choose one tool over another, so I've joined Steve again as he's working.
So use the point or a punch and a metal hammock just because it's faster at taking larger amounts of material off. So you'd use this to get to when you're kind of really roughing out and you need to remove quite big bits of material quite quickly. And then you then move on to a claw chisel, which is, I mean, like what it sounds like. Bricklayers call them scutches, but masons call them claw chisels. So it's like a toothed chisel, and that sort of just kind of refines the surface down a little bit, because this piece has got quite a lot of sort of quite complicated curves in it. It started off as a block that was almost like two cubes on top of each other, and then I've taken material off the top to make it like a tapered shape. And then, because it's going to be a spiral, so you then kind of geometrically to work out how you make a spiral, you take big kind of sort of curves out of the corner. You connect those curves up. Yeah, because the what I'm trying to retain with it, because it's going on, it's quite site specific, this piece. The history of the site is that it used to be a boat yard, but before then it used to be a brick manufacturer. They had a big brick, two big brick kilns there. So the sort of tapered shape, if you look at it square on, I'm trying to retain the sort of tapered shape of a brick chimney. And then as you move to looking at it on the diagonal, you can see the sort of scoops that I've taken out of it to make the spiral. And that sort of represents the kind of water a little bit. For this project, we've had a poem commissioned, and to try and tie in with the site's history. So that's called Bricks and Water, and it's going to go sort of, there's four stanzas of it, so it's kind of like four verses of four lines each. So there's going to be four lines coming from each side, if that makes sense. It's kind of coming up the sculpture, so you have to kind of sort of look round it in order to get the whole line. And we're doing that in raised lettering, so that's going to be drawn down onto the surface, and then you take the negative space away, so you take all the space around it away, so you have like a raised letter, so it'll be quite textural and quite a nice looking thing, hopefully. See, that to me is getting a little bit closer to what I'm after. Still quite rough, but I can start kind of seeing the form, seeing where the lines are going.
Sometimes a mallet and chisel are not quite the right tools for the job, and smoothing off can be quicker using a rasp.
Quite hard sort of Derbyshire stone, so I think it's just neckering the rest. But it's quite nice to get the curves with, you know, obviously they sort of, quite a nice tool to use for, obviously for horses' hooves, so it's sort of, so something like that, you just, once you get down to quite a flat surface, you can use something like that just to kind of get, to pick up the sort of high and low points, and to just start evening it out and making it nice and smooth rather than kind of all over the shelf.
On very hard stone like this sandstone, when a lot of it has to be removed in one go, power tools have their place. But for the finer work, it's back to the mallet and chisel.
Getting quite close, that.
The stone carvers are Steve Roach and Lily Marsh. The Still Alive theme music was composed and played by Frank Birtwistle. The making of Still Alive was supported by the Audio Content Fund. Still Alive is presented and produced by Peter Brooks for UpperHearst.com.